Sunstone Theological Society presents the Book of Mormon, Arminianism, in its 19th century context, recorded live at the 1988 Sunstone Theological Symposium, held August 17th through the 20th, 1988. We take you to the University Park Hotel in Salt Lake City, Utah, where the program is just now beginning.
Mark Thomas, who is reading the paper, is an assistant vice president with C-First Bank in Seattle. He has a degree in philosophy from the University of Utah, an MBA from Northwestern University. He told me that at Northwestern he used to often step next door to the Garrett Theological Seminary, and in fact was accepted to the University of Chicago Divinity School, and then decided to not to go. He opted for money instead of, intellectual. I can't say that either, can I? He opted for banking over theological seminary. On his biography that he gave to me, he said he has three children and one wife. I think he's known to most everyone here. He's had one article in Sunstone Magazine on revival language in the Book of Mormon. He recently presented a paper otherwise in the series that Sunstone sponsors on Book of Mormon. He's authoring a book, Listening to a Voice from the Dust. He's also contributing to a book which is being prepared, New Approaches to the Book of Mormon, in which he is writing on the history and meaning of the sacramental prayers in the Book of Mormon. And so with that, let me let Mark go ahead and read his paper, and then I'll introduce the respondent afterwards.
I'd like to make some preliminary comments to the paper I have to read today, and this is perhaps unfair to the person to comment after me, but I think we'll put in better perspective what I'm trying to do. First of all, my mother-in-law is about to appear into the room, I'm sure, and she is has difficulties sleeping at night and is coming to this in hopes to be able to solve that problem. Perhaps some of you will find similar solace, because what we're dealing with today is what I hopefully will not be too dry and boring, but could be if it were presented with in a normal fashion. Hopefully I can spice it up a bit. We're talking about Arminianism and Calvinism. Now, those are words that are normally not familiar to us. They're not words that we use every day. And so, first of all, let me tell you what I'm doing. I'm talking about Arminianism and Calvinism in the 19th century and comparing those with the Book of Mormon theology. Now, why am I talking about 19th century America when I discuss the Book of Mormon? The obvious answer is I'm trying to prove that the Book of Mormon was written in the 19th century, right? Wrong. I'm not interested in that, though that may be something of interest to other people. I'm really interested in understanding the Book of Mormon. The Book of Mormon quite clearly was addressed to a 19th century audience. Joseph Smith's language was language of the 19th century. Anyone interested in the Book of Mormon has to understand the 19th century. I believe it was written in the 19th century. I believe the Book of Mormon is a product of Joseph Smith. I don't insist upon that interpretation, however, and I hope that all of us can come together, whatever we believe, and listen carefully to the Book of Mormon and its message. That's what interests me the most. Maybe someday I'll believe it's ancient again. I don't know. But that, to me, is not an interesting question. It reminds me of, again, classes I took on the New Testament, that when I remember something like six different theories about who wrote and where it was written, the Book of Hebrews. That's not particularly interesting to me. The Book of Hebrews is a spectacular book, but I want to discuss what is the message of the Book of Mormon, and focus on that rather than its historical origins. Of course, I have bias because I believe Joseph Smith wrote it, and I think that will come out. And again, this is perhaps unfair to my commentator who didn't hear this. But let's begin. First of all, Arminianism and Calvinism. When you use the term Arminianism and Calvinism, they're two systems of belief about human nature. Of course, John Calvin is the ultimate source of not the ultimate source, but that's what Calvinism is named after. Of course, he borrowed ideas from earlier writers. Arminianism is from Arminius, a name of a Reformed theologian, a Dutch Reformed theologian, though the ideas he espoused were actually available at Oxford before he espoused them, but he got the title, Arminianism. So you have two competing doctrines in the Reformed tradition that appear in the 19th century in a specific form. And they're talking about what? About human nature. That's the focus of these two sets of doctrines. What it means to be a human being. Or what we could call religious anthropology. And what I'd like to look at is an overview of the three most popular kinds of Calvinism. There was the old school Calvinist. There was New Haven theologians. And there were the Hopkinsian Calvinists. In 1830, those were the three major forms of Calvinism. Now, New Haven, of course, was from Yale, a certain group of people at Yale that came up with some innovative ideas. Hopkinsian Calvinism was after Hopkins, a disciple of Edwards. And old school Calvinism was kind of the old school that went back to the Westminster Confession. And so you have these three groups of Calvinism. You have basically two forms of Arminianism. And there were other types of Calvinists too. But these were the main, according to a document I have, a contemporary document, these were the major sources numerically. More people believed in these types of Calvinism than other types. Now, Arminianism. What is Arminianism? First of all, there were two types, a liberal and a conservative type. And I'll distinguish between those later on. But let's begin this discussion with an outline of old school Calvinism. There's no way we can possibly cover these movements thoroughly, and so I'm just going to have to touch quickly on some fundamental beliefs. Old school Calvinists held the banner of Calvinism that you find in Orthodoxy, Protestant Orthodoxy. And when you think of Calvinism, you think of a fairly pessimistic view of human nature, predestination, the view that certain people are elected by God from the foundation of the world to be saved, and other people are elected from the foundation of the world to be damned. And it is impossible to become perfect in this life, even for the elect. Those are some of the major tenets of old school Calvinism. Now, we look at that, and it looks like a fairly pessimistic point of view. And from our point of view, I think for most of us, it is. You know, that life is predestined; that there's not much we can do about it. That God is the source of all good, and that we are incapable of good because of the fall. We are incapable of doing anything good. We are totally corrupt. Our souls are depraved. And though human nature may be a temple of God, yet it's a temple that has been sacked and ruined, and only retains a former impression of its glory, a glimmer of a bright light that God once placed in the creation. So this is a God-centered theology, and I think that's the most important thing to understand about old school Calvinism. They're not beating up human beings, they're trying to glorify God. For us to believe that we are free, that we're radically free, is to say something bad about God. God is everything. God is all, and we mere humans don't merit much. In fact, in old school Calvinism, the great sin is pride. Pride precedes every sin. So don't think too highly of yourself, or else you'll make a mistake. So, and that's kind of an outline of some of the things they believed in. Now, this was almost universally accepted system of belief by 18th century Puritans. They followed the Westminster Confession and the Savoy Declaration, and that's, you know, and it gets more detailed than that, but that's essentially what they believed in. Now, in the 18th century, you have challenges to this. What were they? There were some people by the name of Taylor and Whitby who were Arminians. Now, what does Arminianism mean? In American theology, Arminianism is anybody that disagrees with Calvinism. So, you know, as long as you're religious and believe in God and you hate Calvinism, you're an Arminianist. So it's really a cluster of groups that believed in a variety of things. And we can distinguish between liberal and conservatives in a minute. But the central thing that Arminians believed in versus the Calvinist was freedom. Salvation is free. I remember reading a diary of a Methodist who were conservative Arminians. And they would say that. I went to such and such a place, and I preached free salvation. I preached salvation was free. That's all I said about their sermon. And that's enough to say, we're free. Now this idea that salvation is free meant really two things to a Methodist and to the Arminians. I think it stems from a sermon, a very famous sermon by John Wesley. Salvation is free in all and free for all, Wesley said. He was the father of American Methodism. They read his sermons constantly. What he meant by that was that salvation was available to everybody. That was a free gift. It was free in the sense that it's given by grace. And it was free also in the sense that it was available to everyone. Old school Calvinists typically believed, or at least many of them, that the atonement was made only for the elect. Only those who were elect would be saved. Whereas the Arminians and certain other Calvinists believed that the atonement was made for everyone. Salvation is free for anybody, the Methodists, Arminians would say. So freedom versus determinism. That's one of the big challenges that came up. And of course that fits in with the American spirit. The Calvinists were declining because the political notions of America were really opposed to the idea of predestination. And so Methodists were on the rise, Free Will Baptists and others who believed in freedom, or freedom in a radical sense. So freedom versus determinism. That was a big debate, and still is today, but I think it was even more so then. And that was the major distinguishing point between Calvinists and Arminians. Now, how did Calvinists respond to this Arminian threat? First of all, some of them clung tighter to their Calvinism and defended it staunchly. The old school keeps going on. But there were others who changed it. They realized, wait, this isn't going to work. Or, wait, maybe we really are free. We really do seem to make choices. So you have the Hopkinsians coming up with some new ideas, and they're on one side, and you have on the other side the New Haven theologians coming up with some rather novel ideas to try to defend Calvinism. In fact, in Joseph Smith's time, there were people that doubted whether New Haven Calvinism was Calvinism at all, because they also believed in freedom. They were the first Calvinists that I know of that quite broadly started saying salvation is free. You find that same phrase in their literature. They also believed we were free. And of course that was shocking to Calvinists, and it was shocking to the Arminians. Well, we've got brethren here. We're glad you finally came around. So it's a little more complicated than that, but the fact is they started adopting some of the Arminian notions, or at least modifying them. So that's what's happening. You have this kind of watering down. By the time the Book of Mormon was published, a watering down of Calvinism in two other forms. Now, comparing the Book of Mormon to these systems of belief. First of all, freedom versus determinism. And for those of you that came in late, let me again repeat the notion that I'm after here. The Book of Mormon addresses a 19th century audience, quite clearly. It intends to address the audience when it came forth. It addresses it in the language of Joseph Smith. And just as every language has certain overtones and connotations, and the language of Joseph Smith was not the language of today. If we can understand that language, we can understand the language of the Book of Mormon and understand its message better. So that's my concern here, is to understand the message of the Book of Mormon. And we have to understand that by beginning with the original audience of the Book of Mormon, 19th century America. Okay, so freedom versus determinism. For old school Calvinists, God's glory is the end of creation, and all our actions are controlled either by God or Satan. To declare a radical human freedom was sacrilege because it diminished God's glory. Old school Calvinists followed Calvin's teachings that God's will, by definition, was righteous. In other words, whatever God said was right. If God said jump off a cliff is right, that is right. Why? Because God said it. So God's will is right. Now, there's nothing prior to God's will that determines what's right and wrong for old school Calvinists. Okay? Now, why did God elect certain people to be saved and other people to be damned? There is no reason for it. There's no rational reason behind it. It's simply God's will. And since God's will is right, that is right. Okay? Okay, the doctrine of predestination taught by old school Calvinists is based on the belief that everything, even human motives and actions, have a cause. Or more precisely, for everything that has happened, there are conditions such that, given those conditions, nothing else could have happened. That's really a form of determinism, that the world is like a big clock winding down and everything is set. Now, that's the old school. On the other hand, you have Hopkins and Emmons and other Hopkinsian Calvinists who believed that also that God's decrees determined everything. But, in contrast to old school Calvinists, they believed that there was a moral law, there was a law set up in nature that's what determined what was right and wrong, not simply God's arbitrary will. In fact, Hopkinsians would go as far to say what was startling to all sides of the debate here, that God is the cause of everything, therefore God is the cause of evil. That's pretty scary. Calvinists for a long time had been trying to sidestep that. Hopkinsians said no, especially Emmons, would say that God is the author of sin and evil, and that they borrowed a phrase from philosophy that to get the best of all possible worlds, you have to have evil. There's no way you can have a world that doesn't have evil if you want the best of all possible worlds. So they also said that humans are capable of doing good. We have the power to do good, but we don't have the will to do good because our hearts are corrupted. We're totally corrupt. Therefore, we have the natural ability, but the moral inability to do right. So, hence we're still just as predestined as ever. But they could somehow say we were free because we really could choose, even though we won't. So this is, again, trying to get out of get the idea that we're free and not free. Now, this was an important thing for them. Hopkinsians said, yes, we're free. We're free because we do make choices. When I woke up this morning, I decided to eat cornflakes. Now, I could have eaten bran flakes, but I didn't. I did make a free choice there. But the Hopkinsians say, the Calvinists, God's will, there's this great mechanism in nature that determined by outside forces, my parents, my upbringing, and my own heredity, that's determined that, yes, I would choose cornflakes. So, yes, even though I do make free choices, they're determined, and God is the source of that choice. It's the same as if we throw a rock and it goes into water and splashes. There's no difference, ultimately, even for the Hopkinsians. The Hopkinsians are trying to make the case that we are free and not free at the same time. God determines everything, but in some sense we're free. Okay? Now, the New Haven theologians finally broke rank. It was too much for them. They finally couldn't hold to that belief. And so in 1818, Nathaniel Taylor published a work that was important, and later his works and others in this school held to the same belief. And the work was entitled, A Free Man, A Free Agent Without Aids of Divine Grace. And that's an Arminian notion. And so you have the New Haven Calvinists finally breaking down and saying, okay, we're free. And the reasons that they chose were the Arminian reasons. And they're very good reasons, I think. First of all, to say that there is right and wrong is to say that we are free. That's the basic argument. If there is no freedom, I'm not to blame for anything. If I kill someone, I might be sent to a hospital. Someone might pity me, but they certainly wouldn't blame me. They certainly wouldn't say I was wrong. And I think that's a very powerful argument. The whole notion of right and wrong is based on the idea of responsibility. If you believe in responsibility, if you in fact believe that human beings have a sense of right and wrong, you have to believe in freedom. That's part of the package. Now, I consider that. It comes from the Scottish school of philosophers, and it's one that came to America, and I consider a very powerful argument for freedom. That, in fact, morality is evidence that we are free beings. If there is right and wrong, we are free beings, because the notion of right and wrong is tied up with freedom. Now, okay, so most Calvinists believed in predestination. New Haven Calvinists, plus the Arminians, believed in freedom. Those are the two schools. But the conservative Arminians believed in a third position, and this is the key position. They believed that freedom was not innate, but was a gift from the atonement. So that's the third position. One, you have predestination from the Calvinists, New Haven Calvinists, and the liberal Arminians believed in innate freedom, that we are born free, and the conservative Calvinists, that the atonement gives us freedom. Now, let me read something from the Book of Mormon here. From Lehi. And the Messiah cometh in the fullness of time, that he may redeem the children of men from the fall. And because that they are redeemed from the fall, they have become free forever. Clearly a conservative Arminian notion, the idea that freedom comes from the atonement. Now, what happens is that we are corrupt. Conservative Arminians believed in innate depravity. Yes, we're corrupt. We can't do good. But infused into us is grace. And that grace gives every human being at birth the choice to choose. So it's God's grace that's infused in us that gives us freedom. Everyone has that freedom at birth. Now, okay, so you say they believe in freedom, but they also had a twist, conservative Arminians. Yes, but God can see everything that happens. Hence, in the scriptures, God can predict what will happen. Let me give you some rationality without quoting them, but you see it quite a bit. You see it also in Scottish philosophers, where they borrowed it. Suppose I'm climbing a hill. Again, I wake up and eat my cornflakes, and God knows that I will do that, even though I'm free to do that. Whatever. So I start marching up the hill. I have chosen beforehand to do that, and all my choices are free. No one causes me to do them. And it's a freer sense than in the Hopkinsians. The Hopkinsians say that your volitions are free, meaning that you're free in the sense that you make choices even though they're predetermined. Now, for the Arminians, it's something more than that. You really can choose, and you could have chosen the bran flakes if you wanted. Okay? So the Arminians really believe in a more stronger sense of freedom. Okay, I can climb this mountain in the morning, the Arminians say, but God knows what will happen. He knows the weather. He knows what earthquakes might happen. He knows everything that will happen. He knows my motives. He knows what I will choose. Yes, I will choose freely, but conservative Arminians will say, God will know everything that you will choose. Now, that seems hard for us to swallow, I think, but it was a typical belief. The notion that God knows everything, even though I'm free. Okay? He doesn't make me free. Now, that's the difference between Calvinists. Calvinists would say, God makes you choose, but an Arminian would say, God will know what you will do, but he doesn't step in and do anything. So there's a difference there, and it's an important difference. Now, in fact, they said that the notion, just as a sidelight, Nathan Bangs in 1815 said that Calvinist position is a contradiction. Because what they say is, okay, God commands us not to sin in the Bible, and yet he's the source of sin. Because everything that happens is predestined. So you can't buy that. Nathan Bangs also knocked down the idea of the decrees of God, that God decreed from the beginning of the world what would happen. That's the doctrine of decrees. He says, no, that's not the case. There is a sense of decrees, but it's not in that sense that God decrees that those that sin will go to hell, and God decrees that those that are righteous will go to heaven. That's what decrees are. God decrees in a sense of freedom. That's the only sense we can believe in the notion of decrees, Nathan Bangs argues. Now, so, first of all, we've already seen how the Book of Mormon accepts the conservative Arminian notion that freedom comes from the atonement, from the atonement of Christ. It's a gift. Now, the second thing in the Book of Mormon that I think is also interesting is that it adopts first of all, let me add here, the notion of freedom coming from the atonement was called by Wesley the light of Christ. The light of Christ comes into your life at birth. That light is a paraphrase from John 1, the light that shineth in every, whatever. The light of Christ. Quakers also use the phrase, but in a different sense, and I think the Book of Mormon uses it in the Wesleyan sense. The light of Christ is that light which shineth in every individual. And Moroni says, and that's what gives us freedom and righteousness for us depraved human beings. Okay. Moroni exhorts us, quote, search diligently in the light of Christ, that ye may know good from evil. Okay, etc. So the Book of Mormon and conservative Arminians believed in this grace, the light of Christ, as the vehicle for freedom and all righteousness. Now, also there's a notion in the Book of Mormon, quote, that the Lord knoweth all things from the beginning, wherefore he prepareth a way to accomplish all his works. Mormon says, God knoweth all things which are to come. So in the Book of Mormon, you have a pretty strong notion that God knows everything in the future. He knows that exactly 116 pages will be lost. He knows that Joseph Smith will be named Joseph Smith. He knows that all sorts of free actions will take place. And I think it's quite clear from these quotes that God knoweth all things from the beginning, which are to come. I think that's a pretty plain statement that the Book of Mormon holds that conservative Arminian notion of freedom from the atonement and absolute foreknowledge of God. Okay. And the notion of decrees is a notion that's Arminian. Quote, the decrees of God are unalterable. This is from Alma. The decrees of God are unalterable. Therefore, the way is prepared that whosoever will may walk therein and be saved. Notice it's saying that, yes, the decrees are prepared that if you walk in the way of salvation, you will be saved. Shades of Nathan Bangs. Okay. Now, means, the use of means. There were certain Calvinists, the old school Calvinists, believed in the doctrine of inability. What they meant by that is that you sit in a revival and you wait for God to touch your heart. The means of salvation, preaching and praying and reading the Bible, those means cannot convert you. Only God can convert you by touching your heart. And if you try to get converted, if you try to work yourself up like these crazy revivalists that Joseph Smith sees, like these crazy people, these Methodists and these crazy, some of the crazy Presbyterians you see, that's a human work. Salvation is by grace. So you see the Methodists, but this was shocking. See, this was shocking to the revivalists. They said, how could this be that you don't even try for salvation? So they would chastise, the Arminians and the New Haven theologians chastise the old school. They were procrastinating the day of their repentance, doing something, leaving for God what they could do for themselves. Notice in the Book of Mormon that the Zoramites, who believed in the doctrine of election, were also chastised for procrastinating the day of their repentance. So, the Book of Mormon, again, sides with the conservative Arminians in believing in means, believing that you need to go out there and try to convert people, that it's not, a revival is not a work of God, conversion is not the work of God totally, it's the work of humans as well. Again, that God is beginning to be replaced by human beings. And that's really the ultimate difference between Arminianism and Calvinism, in my view. Instead of having God, the cause of everything, you start to have humans creep in and being the cause of certain things. One of them, the conversion of their fellow human beings. Okay, now let's turn. How much time have we got?
Five or 10 minutes.
And I can see that it's working. What I said before. So I'll make this quick. What I'd said at the first of the speech. Okay, so let's turn quickly to and touch basically on the notion of the fall and total depravity. It was believed by old school Calvinists that human beings were, quote, earthly, sensual, and devilish. Behold, they desire that the Lord their God, who has created them, should not rule and reign over them. Nevertheless, his great goodness and his mercy towards them, they do set at naught his counsels, and they will not that he should be their guide. Oh, how great is the nothingness of the children of men. Yea, even they are less than the dust of the earth. How eloquent. I mean, that goes along with Hamlet's soliloquy about how noble men are. I mean, that's the exact reverse, but just as eloquent. One other statement. Ether prays, Lord, forgive us for our sins, because we know that our natures are corrupt because of the fall. So we have a sense of depravity in the Book of Mormon that was with old school Calvinists and conservative Arminians. Same language, lost and fallen state. You know, the natural man is an enemy to God. You see that in Calvin's 19th century works. You see that in a half a dozen 19th century authors. The natural man is an enemy to God. What does that mean? As one Calvinist said, the unregenerated man is an enemy to God. The unconverted man is an enemy to God. We by nature are corrupt and evil. And that's a common 19th century notion in conservative Arminian and Calvinist positions. Okay, we'll have to skip all of this. What we get here, One other thing, the notion of sanctification, that perfection is possible in this life. The Book of Mormon tells us that Ether was sanctified, three Nephites were sanctified, others were sanctified. What this means is that they received a state of holiness. In 3 Nephi it says that they no longer were tempted by the devil. They were perfect. This was a big debate in the 19th century. Old school Calvinists believed you could not be perfect. Arminians believed you could. And this was a big thing that John Wesley infused into American Methodism, perfectionism. Other people picked it up in the New Haven schools, such as Finney and others. New Havens were split on this issue. The point that I'm getting to here is that the Book of Mormon sides consistently on every point with conservative Arminianism. And the other schools, the other three Calvinist schools, the liberal Arminianism, differ in one or more points. Now, once we begin to understand the theology of the Book of Mormon, we see how foreign it is to our own view. It's both an offense and an attraction to the current reader in the 20th century. we can see, first of all, this negative view of human nature that's difficult to grasp, and that everything is essentially foreign to every impulse, good or bad, is attributable to God or evil. Everything is projected. Even freedom is given to us as a gift. Guilt is projected as a law of justice. Sin and evil are symbolized as stains, chains, sleep, a mist of darkness. And projected into God is every good human quality, and into the devil every evil human quality. So what we have in the Book of Mormon is an understanding of human nature that rests upon projecting the inner human soul upon the world. What it is, the Book of Mormon makes the subjective objective. It makes the soul, makes a picture of the world from the soul. Now, we don't have time to go into depth the interesting thing that this presents. But I can simply state this, that it's a simplified view of the world. It's a simple way of seeing things. It's very useful because it helps us see ourselves. And the difficulty with it is that if we hold to it too fast and too tight to this projection, to this simplification, the summary of life, we can call it, we become dogmatic and lack curiosity. To ascribe all good to God is ultimately an erosion of responsibility. It's nice to put the world in neat packages. But actually, unfortunately or fortunately, the world is a complicated place. We are all saints and sinners. Every human is a prophet. To receive revelation is part of the human condition. We are never in total apostasy or total restoration. Faith and doubt are brethren. They go together. I believe what the Book of Mormon has to give us is an important step, but it is a first step. If we cannot go beyond it, if that's all we have, then it's simply like staying at home with our parents. But the genius of the Book of Mormon message is this, is that God is the deliverer. He delivers from starvation, from enemies, from cruel nature, from the power of evil. God becomes the conqueror of will over nature, of human subjectivity over fate and necessity. When God calms the storm at sea and delivers Nephi from bonds, for the reader he delivers the longing of the heart, the desire to overcome the constraints of earthly life. God delivers by miraculous means. God rules nature. When God says peace to the storm, he was actually whispering peace to the heart of the reader. God is the guarantor of the human heart, its longing for certainty, purity, and eternal life. This is the greatness of the Book of Mormon message on human nature. It combines tragedy with freedom. Yes, we are trapped. We will all die. We will all experience guilt. None of us, no one, has lived to his or her potential. Yes, we are trapped, and we are guilty. Yet in that confinement, we are free to escape. We are liberated in prison. We find life and joy and peace, the essential things of life, in the Book of Mormon. So while the Book of Mormon sorrows at the universal corruption and limited nature of human life, it also rejoices and invites us to rejoice and escape into freedom, joy, and peace.
Thank you, Mark. Let me introduce the respondent, Stephen Makita, who is the Assistant Attorney General for Utah.
Not me.
An Assistant Attorney General for Utah, representing the Department of Health, and has a BA from Duke University in Religion and Political Science, and a degree from the University of Utah Law School.
BYU.
Oh, from BYU, I'm sorry. I was making some notes, you can tell, hastily at the beginning here. And Stephen is also a convert to Mormonism, and so has the benefit of having been outside the movement and also now inside. Let me move the mic over and then allow him to respond.
I'll make my comments as brief as possible so that those of you who are dying to go to the masturbation lecture may. the main thrust, Mark has kind of changed his ending. He hasn't changed his hidden agenda. My parents didn't send me to law school for nothing, and I knew quite clearly that he believes that the Book of Mormon is a 19th century document. That does not disarm me in the least. Just to be able to focus my comments and your thoughts over the entire lecture, I think that Mark gives several very good summaries of what his point are in his paper. Let me just read them. In summary, the Book of Mormon agrees with conservative Arminians in every instance in the area of freedom through the atonement, the absolute foreknowledge of God, the understanding of decrees and providence, and the use of means or human works in preaching and conversion. The Book of Mormon disagrees with the other Calvinist and Arminian schools on one or more of these points, thus aligning Book of Mormon theology to conservative Arminians. Arminianism. And then he states towards the end, prior to stating the theological consequences of these findings, that the Book of Mormon agrees with conservative Arminians in their doctrine of foreknowledge and of freedom due to the atonement, the light of Christ as infused grace, universal atonement, innate depravity of the natural man, the conversion process, and sanctification in this life. In short, every aspect of the doctrine of man, or what he refers to as religious anthropology, is Arminian. Now he's, let me read his ending, which disturbed me, which I think underlies his purpose in writing this. But the Book of Mormon is more than a mere projection. This is Mark. It is a holy book, a scripture. We must abandon the idea that the Book of Mormon is the fullness of the gospel. The book is still a universal revelation and a spiritual center. The book is universal because it addresses universal existential issues. In an objective sense, the Book of Mormon is no different than the Quran or the Bhagavad Gita. They are all universal revelations, yet each of these books provide a spiritual center for a particular community of believers. In that sense, they are quite different. Everyone has a spiritual center. The Book of Mormon provides a spiritual center for Mormons. While the book is universal in its existential concerns, and this is the important part, it expresses those concerns in the confines of 19th century theology, language, and symbolism. And it is from that spiritual center that we Mormons project our messages upon the world. Okay. Now, at the outset, I must confess that I didn't spend my time at Duke with James Charlesworth talking about 19th century America, and I'm no scholar on those issues which dominated the religious landscape of the time. To that degree, I'm tremendously impressed with Mark's cogent survey on the competing schools of thought existing at the time of the discovery and translation of the Book of Mormon. His discussion of Calvinist and Arminian theologies and the theological debate in which they were passionately engaged, I found to be readily comprehensible and intellectually stimulating. His thesis that Book of Mormon theology echoes the underpinnings of conservative Arminianism is compelling, enlightening, and in certain respects disturbing. One cannot disagree with the proposition, his proposition, that the terminology and specific language that our Book of Mormon translator relied upon reflect the historical context in which Joseph found himself. It is not surprising, but quite predictable, therefore, that the language of the Book of Mormon would contain 19th century phraseology or the rhetoric of the 19th century. Joseph had no other language at his disposal. Unquestionably, this ancient Hebraic document's word choice, the word choice, not the theology, but the word choice explaining that theology, is unmistakably 19th century Joseph. And thus, its similarities to the words driving the Calvinist-Arminian debate are easily isolated and textually conspicuous. There's nothing surprising about that. Joseph Smith was a 19th century man. He was translating from an environment. He didn't just walk into a void. So the language he was using was 19th century. So far, so good. Merely because there is a similarity, however, between our translator's words and Arminian theology does not justify the conclusion or the illogical leap that somehow Joseph had consciously aligned himself, had consciously and intentionally aligned himself with the followers of Arminius. Rather, the subjects and issues which fueled the theological tempest in Joseph's milieu, 19th century America, were and are perennially and inherently linked to Scripture. The Arminian Calvin debate might have been unique in terms of phraseology, but their subjects, the subjects which fueled the debate, that is, free will, determinism, election, covenant, sanctification, were all theological restatements of age-old debates, which did not have the genesis in the 19th century, but which arose and still spring from the source, Holy Writ. Such issues, not the language, but the issues, determinism, free will, the depravity of man, but the ideology contained therein, have their historical antecedents, which I believe Mark fails to mention, in the musings of Augustine, Aristotle, and the writers of the Bible. And thus, these issues are not unique to Joseph's day or to the theologians which were discussing the issues. Thus, linguistic anthropologic appraisal of the Book of Mormon as 19th century certainly does not mean that the theology, not the language, but the theology of Book of Mormon and Arminius are somehow contemporaries. They are causally linked by language and not through some hidden theological agenda of our translator and his environment. It was Arminius, not Book of Mormon theology or authors, who was the rookie to the game, to the theological game or debate. And thus, the Book of Mormon had not and did not join the later debate. It is important to reaffirm that Joseph's role was limited to translation by inspiration and not interpretation via redaction. That was not his role. His license had been carefully restricted to the simple mechanics of language, not of theological interjection. It was only later, not at the time of the translation, it was only later when Joseph became theologically primed and preoccupied. Mr. Thomas's own word choice, which seems to couple Book of Mormon theology, not seems, but does, couple the Book of Mormon theology with the Arminian movement with such terms as Book of Mormon sides with, the Book of Mormon agrees that, Book of Mormon contains anti-Calvin rhetoric in the Book of Mormon, the Book of Mormon insists with the Arminians. His own word choice demands qualification and clarification concerning these ancient theological questions. One final point that Mark makes in his conclusion, or the conclusion that I read, which I think underlies his entire endeavor, deserves brief comment. It seems as if Mark, by explaining the Book of Mormon's religious anthropology, i.e., its doctrine of man, is really challenging the primacy of the scripture. He exhorts us to, quote, abandon the idea that the Book of Mormon is the fullness of the gospel. Such a claim misapprehends the term and definition of, quote unquote, fullness. The Book of Mormon does not contain, and never has purported to contain, an exhaustive inventory of Mormon thought and revelation, but it does include all of those doctrines necessary for man's eternal salvation and earthly happiness. That is its complete and immutable message. Our maturity and adult curiosity should not be threatened by the book's pristine simplicity. That is why it was brought forth, to simplify and to be precise. Its central significance in our lives transcends both the prophet's provincial tongue and Arminianism's parochial and largely peripheral influence on the prophet. Thank you very much.
We have time for a few questions. Anybody, please?
I actually resent the reference by Mr. Makita to Mr. Thomas's quote unquote hidden agenda. I don't think there's anything hidden about it at all. It's very straightforward. I think it's at the outset that consider the Book of Mormon to be an ancient doctrine, though it seems right to suggest that perhaps at some future time this might be possible. I guess my feeling is that, and indeed given my own research in the area of the Book of Mormon and Masticon, where I suppose my conclusions seem to side very much with those of Mr. Thomas. It seems to me that...
Well, it's not surprising then that you would resent my comments.
But it seems to me that your argument that the text use the language of the text. I mean, I think that Mr. Thomas's reference to language and very important terms in the Book of Mormon that seem very much reflected in the theology of conservative Calvinism. If we can't work with that kind of thing, my goodness, what can we work with?
Well,
if you're going to say that everything in the Book of Mormon can be traced back to, say, as far as Plato, well, that's not really quite far enough as yet, as I see it. You've got to demonstrate for me that everything before 6th century, the Jewish... Babylonian exile. I think before that, somehow have Arminians living, in the 7th century BCE. I think this is an absurd suggestion, and I really don't think you can demonstrate it.
Okay. First of all, merely because another person, I mean, it's interesting that, you know, you're not resentful at all of what he says, but you are resentful of mine, and I question your openness and your scholar and your scholarship. Secondly, I don't want you to misunderstand what I'm saying. What I'm saying is, yes, Mark Thomas and those acolytes like you, yes, I agree that the language of the 19th century, but that doesn't, merely because Joseph is using 19th century language in translating this book, it misunderstands Joseph. Joseph wasn't consciously aware of these debates. He had no personal or theological stake in the matter at the time of translation. And so you and the Mark Thomases of the world are trying to elevate the theological knowledge and wisdom of Joseph Smith at the time of translation. Well, it's funny that you would not say it's conscious if you're just looking at it not from a faith perspective, but merely from a logical, rational perspective. I think you would have to make that concession. There would have to be conscious. Okay, now let me make a final point. There is no causal connection but for the language. Merely because the language is 19th century does not mean that, first of all, the debate began with Joseph Smith and Arminians and Calvinists. He is merely injecting 19th century language to describe something that the Book of Mormon authors were discussing. That's much more logical in terms of, you know, there just ain't no causal connection. You guys are making this giant linkage between 19th century language and Joseph Smith injecting himself in the Book of Mormon into this greater debate. And I just don't see it.
Mark, you wouldn't insist that someone dealing with this with these kinds of problems in with regard to the Book of Mormon, if he were to use categories like Arminianism and Calvinism, would automatically assume from the outset that this was a 19th century text, would you?
No.
Yeah. So that you could use those categories and still assume that it was an ancient text.
That's right. In fact, I think one of the most important things that's happened in Book of Mormon research is Blake Osler's article in Dialogue. What he says is that Joseph Smith essentially redacted the Book of Mormon. He edited it to get these ancient ideas into a modern context. I think it's a remarkable article. It's not one that I agree with, but what he is saying is that it doesn't make a difference. For example, my article, suppose that we discovered today, this is really a terrible article. I really just dug it up, and it's an ancient Chinese document. Would it make any difference in your opinion about this article? I don't think so. Now, it may make a difference the way you interpret it. In the Book of Mormon, why is it important that you say the Book of Mormon is ancient or modern? One reason. Because it will tell you how much authority the message of the book has. If it's an ancient book, if an angel came, if it came through inspiration, it provides the ultimate... This is probably the most important book in the world. If it is from the tongue of Joseph Smith, maybe it's that important too, but maybe not. I mean, you know, it's a whole different ballgame. If this is a projection of the human soul upon the world, it's a different book than, in fact, if there was a Nephi that wandered around. So there is a big difference. But I say, the message is no different. Do the pages change if it's ancient? Does the type change if it's ancient? What changes? Nothing. Why can't we listen to the book? We beat each other up so much trying to figure out, you know, who cares if it was written in China or Mongolia or Russia? I don't care. I really don't care. I want to listen to this book because it's part of me. I'm a Mormon. It means a lot to me. And it tells me how to achieve life and eternal life. And we talked about this. I think my hidden agenda is the same as yours. We're trying to get life. And what does that mean? That means peace. It means joy. In the midst of a world that we can't control, in a world that has overpowered us, we can find joy and peace and love. I mean, we're free even though we're trapped. And that's the message. And I find it, I think it's great. Now, all of this stuff is baloney. I mean, I'm trying to get to that message. What it boils down to is a simple message. And that's what we need to listen to. This is just a means to that message.
And thank you, everybody.
Thanks, Luke.